Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I speak with Paresh Patel, who's currently the Chief of Appeals at the Office of the Federal Defender for the District of Maryland. He's been at the Federal Public Defender since 2003. In this role, he represents clients on post-conviction matters, including direct appeal and federal habeas. He also assists trial attorneys on complex legal issues that arise in their cases. Before his time at the Federal Defender, he worked as a staff attorney at the Public Defender Service in Washington, D.C., and the Office of the Appellate Defender in New York, New York. He started his career clerking for the Honorable Judge Hagerty of the United States District Court for the District of Oregon in Portland. He's a graduate of American University's Washington College of Law, go Eagles, and the University of Southern California, go Trojans. So great to have you, Paresh. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Paresh, you've been a public defender basically your entire career since finishing your clerkship. So I was hoping we could just start by telling me about the decision to become a public defender, sort of how you made it and why you decided to sort of make this your professional path.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, when I went to law school, I had no idea I wanted to be a public defender or that I even wanted to go into criminal law. But the first sign was my criminal law class that I took. I'm like, wow, I really like it. Stood out from all the other classes. I was feeling a bit down, actually, in law school after the first semester because I didn't get to criminal law until the second semester. But it was just a natural high, I think, when I took the class. So it started from there. But really, where the public defender part came in, I think, was the summer I interned at the Judiciary Committee. It was on the subcommittee on the Constitution. That's what they call it now. But the 1994 crime bill was in the making at that time. And so I got to work on that. I was working for a very liberal congressman. His views aligned with mine, so that was very good. And I was working on a bill to introduce statistics that would allow statistics to be introduced about racial disparity in death penalty cases. And I think I was really naive. I'm like, why wouldn't everybody want that? What's wrong with this? It would just make the system more fair. But there was a lot of opposition, not just from the Republicans, but also from the Democrats. So I think I went in as a very naive young law student thinking, of course, the Democrats are going to be fair-minded on the side of defendants. They're not that political. But as that crime bill was going through, there were so many horrible provisions. And, you know, we've seen the effects. It's partly the reason we have mass incarceration in the United States today. So I was there in the beginning in 1994. And people like Joe Biden, who I'm glad he's president now, but he was really pushing the bill with these mandatory minimums and all these Bill Clinton and all these liberals, also called liberals in the Senate and in the House, were pushing it. So I thought that was the first experience where my eyes were wide open to how unfair the laws are. And that happens because of politics on both sides. So I think that was the first time like, okay, I like criminal law, and now I want to go and practice and be a public defender. So from there on, I started doing internships at public defender offices and then, you know, became a public defender and have never gone back.
Well, as a law professor, I love that story for a couple of reasons. The first reason, of course, being that you found you didn't come to law school necessarily with a particular area of practice in mind, and it was a classes that sort of sparked your interest. So the takeaway, of course, is take more classes because you until you find that spark, you don't know where you're going to find it. The other great takeaway is I think some people think that the only way to affect change as a lawyer is to stand up in court. And as you pointed out, right, a lot of the legislative process at the federal level and of course at the state level right now has a huge impact. I mean, it's sort of like telling people you can be good at the game, But if the rules are stacked against you, it doesn't matter how good you are. And so I think both of those things is sort of ways of thinking about our mental models for a career in the law are really, really powerful.
I think it's very important that we have good, smart people in Congress and the committees. I mean, you can make a huge difference there. I've been a public defender for a long time and I practice federal law. So often I go back to that time and I'm like, oh my God, I remember when that rule was being made. And what were they? Because legislative intent is also very important. So, you know, I try to think about what were they really thinking at the time that they made that rule. So, yes, very important.
That's a pretty unique experience. You did say that you found criminal law exciting in a way that you didn't find your other classes as exciting. And I guess I'm wondering what was so exciting about it? Was it the people, the topics? Was it the type of law? What drew you to that particular class?
I think it was, that was the first time the law didn't seem abstract to me. I guess there are other areas of the law where there's real people involved. It's not corporations, it's not money. But it felt like you're dealing with people's everyday problems, right? That's a part of criminal defense. And it felt very real. It felt down on the ground to me. And then, you know, I also just loved the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment. And that came a little later, you know, in the second year when I was taking criminal procedure. But that really reinforced my love for it. I loved Law and Order, even though it was very government prosecutor oriented, but it was like putting this into practice. But I really thought like you're dealing with real people on both sides, like the victims and the defendants. And there's a lot of tragedy involved there. There's a lot of drama, but it's so interesting because I also thought that it allows you to get into people's lives more directly than maybe other areas of the law, especially like in sentencing mitigation. The humanity of your client is very, very important. And so I like that part of it too, that human aspect of it. But I also just loved criminal law and the practice of it. And I just thought Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, I was just very drawn to all of that also.
That's fantastic. I guess the next question I want to ask is sort of the, what would I see if I followed you around all day? What are your days like? You know, what, you know, I know you work, you know, obviously you work for a federal defender, which is of course different than some of the state and local defenders, and you tend to do a lot of appellate work. But I guess I'm just curious, like, how do you fill your days? Because I know they're full. I'm just curious with what the tasks are that fill them.
You know, it can be very different from day to day. Some of the things I do are direct appeals. And these are appeals in the Fourth Circuit. So people are convicted of a federal crime and then sentenced, and then I'm appealing the cases. So sometimes I'm working, just writing an appeal. And often our cases, there's very few trials in our office. So most of the cases that do go to direct appeal have to do with sentencing, right? So often it's that the judge didn't explain and give the reasoning for a sentence, or the judge got something wrong on what we call the guidelines that we use, the federal sentencing guidelines. There was a calculation that was wrong, and there's a lot of litigation around that. So those tend to be the sentencing appeals. So sometimes I'm just writing, trying to very persuasively convince the court that there was an error made and that it made a difference. But that's not all we do. You know, there's a lot of post-conviction work that I do that's not direct appeal. It's called federal habeas work. That work is like after somebody's been convicted. For example, one of the ways you get back in and get federal habeas relief or ask for federal habeas relief is if there's intervening decisions that come out. So that's been a big part of my job, and that's what I do quite a bit now. That encompasses is taking the cases that we've won in the Supreme Court or at the circuit level. And there's been a lot of them recently. And I'll talk a little bit about that from unexpected allies too in the Supreme Court that have really, really had an impact and narrowed and reduced federal sentences for clients. But often these laws come out after they're convicted and sentenced. So I try to go back in and retroactively get them released. That's resulted in like mass reductions for people. There's been a lot of cases that have come out in the Supreme Court about federal recidivist sentencing enhancements. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of enhancements in federal sentencing where clients get awful mandatory minimums based on prior convictions that they had, state or federal, mostly state, that qualify as crimes of violence or serious drug offenses or controlled substance offenses. There's various terms with various enhancements. But the Supreme Court has taken up a lot of these cases on one of the enhancements called the Armed Career Criminal Act, which means that if you're a felon in possession, just in possession of a firearm, and you have three prior convictions that qualify as violent felony or serious drug offense, you get a mandatory 15 years, right? And it's a mess as to what those definitions mean, violent felony especially. And so we've been litigating hard, and there've been several cases in the Supreme Court about whether certain priors qualify. Well, Justice Scalia has been was one of our biggest believers in our arguments on that, and narrowed the ACCA. And then in 2015, he basically got rid of one part of the violent felony definition, and that's had huge implications. And there's been case after case after case that's come after that. And so every time a case comes out, I go back, and you only have 1 year generally to file. So I've filed hundreds and hundreds petitions, and it takes years to go through that litigation because there's all sorts of things that aren't resolved directly by the Supreme Court case. So that's a big part of what I'm doing currently are these retro. And then there's also the First Step Act, which was passed a few years ago. And that's had a tremendous impact because it had various provisions that resulted in reductions for our clients. One of those provisions, there was a law that reduced the disparity between crack and cocaine in sentencing in 2010. One part of the First Step Act made it retroactive. And so we got a lot of people relief based on that. And there were all sorts of legal questions that came out of there. And so there's appeals that developed from that too about what the law means. And so that's one of it. And then there's another provision called compassionate release provision. And that was amended so that judges were given much more discretion, a wide-ranging discretion to give relief to people. We call it the Second Act chance or Second Chance Act. And so there's been a lot of litigation out of what qualifies as extraordinary and compelling, what the judges can find as extraordinary and compelling to give people this second chance under compassionate release. I've been working on those cases. Also, like some of the litigation from that on appeal, we have a bunch of people in the office that have done sort of the direct work in district court, but have been helping out on some of the legal issues going up to the court. So that's some of the stuff that I do. And then often my day is also full of inquiries from our trial attorneys about issues that come up, legal issues that come up in their cases. And not just from our trial attorneys, in the federal defender system, we're also connected across the country. And so we help each other out. So there are a lot of meetings about how to develop a particular issue, either in district court or in the court of appeals, that's going to have mass impact. So just today, I was on a call for a couple of hours about an important issue pending in the Fourth Circuit, and we have to get it right. Sometimes we're the first ones to go, and so in the Fourth Circuit, and so it's important that we get it right because all the other courts are going to start following if you're the first one. They start piggybacking. There's a lot of that, you know, a lot of strategy talk that I do also. And one last thing I just wanted to say is that, you know, look, even if the law students choose not to go on the path that I did as a defender, there's still opportunity to do that type of work pro bono. So I often work with law firm attorneys who want to do an appeal. So we'll help, we'll supervise them, we'll work with them, and then they get to do the oral argument in the Fourth Circuit. That is a thing that I encourage people to do that go to law firms. Also, it's to get in touch with a federal defender and take on an appeal or sometimes even a trial. So I love working with people, the associates at the law firms too.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And some people might be listening and know all about the sentencing guidelines and the way we sentence. That was a pretty great introduction for those that don't know a whole lot about it. What struck me about the answer also is this idea that you're playing a bunch of different roles at a bunch of different stages, right? Sort of towards the end, what you were talking about was sort of helping change the law, right? Helping to either change it legislatively, supporting those legislative changes, but primarily changing the interpretation of that law in courts, because that's then going to have major implications for far more than the individual for whom you're litigating. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is really unique about appellate advocacy compared to trial advocacy is it really is about what is the rule going forward in our sort of common law system. But at the same time, and I don't think people think about this, or at least I know I didn't, once that happens, it creates a whole host of work to actually make it apply to a bunch of individuals.
Yeah, always. You're never done, right?
Right. You're never done, exactly.
But that's what's so exciting about the law. It's really hopeful too. I started 18 and a half years ago now in this office, and it was looking pretty bleak for federal defendants, right? At that time, the guidelines were mandatory and they were very harsh, the sentencing guidelines. And a couple of years after I started, that law fell. The Supreme Court found that the mandatory guidelines were unconstitutional, and so they made them advisory. And then it's been a progress since then, a huge progress that I've seen. I've also seen a difference in the way prosecutors, their attitudes toward our clients. Yeah, so when I first came here, I think it was a part of the culture too. The guidelines were mandatory, so it was just like robots. Even the prosecutor, everybody was like, okay, we're stuck with these guidelines. There's not much wiggle room here to get out of them. And so I think even the prosecutors and the judges it just became a part of this brainwashing of like, well, this is what's fair. And this is what the commission said. And we just took that as the Bible, right? Once the Supreme Court changed and said, these are just advisory and you just start with them, but nobody is bound. The judges aren't bound to them. The attorneys aren't bound. The government's not bound by, nobody's bound by them, right? There's just one thing that the court can look at, right? It took a while to get away from that, because there's a lot of flaws, I think, in the guidelines too. They were made by humans in the sentencing commission, and some of them came about without empirical research behind them. It was just based on attitudes of everything should be harsh. Everyone should be getting the worst punishment. But now I think it's been so long since the change happened, I think prosecutors are more willing to step back and say, okay, well, I agree. I don't think that this guideline is appropriate for the client. And in most of our cases now, we work out deals where the prosecutors agree that the guideline in the book is not the right guideline for a client. And so they'll agree to a departure or a variance from the guideline based on human factors, right? The case, Booker versus United States, which got rid of the mandatory, it opened up the minds of everyone, not just us, but also the prosecutors. And so I've seen a big change in the way that the government looks at sentencing, at least in our district, in the District of Maryland. So it's been nice to see that on all sides become a bit more progressive, or a lot more progressive.
Yeah. And that's interesting to me also. You know, when I was clerking on the district court, that was the first experience I had with the federal sentencing guidelines. It was not something that was covered in criminal law or criminal procedure when I took them in law school. And I saw that, as you noted, right, the reason when most people plea, right, when most people come to an agreement, the only thing, as you said, or the primary thing you can fight about is whether or not the sentence was appropriate under the guidelines. And I'd be curious what your thoughts are. I mean, my understanding of the sort of impetus behind the guidelines and creating them in the first place was not necessarily to be 100% harsh, but rather to sort of even out across judges in what was happening in courtrooms across America that were not equal, but in practice, they may have actually made it more harsh than less. Is that sort of an accurate?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Jonah. I mean, I think that, you know, the people who championed the guy, Justice Breyer was one of them in the Supreme Court, and, Senator Kennedy, I think all of these people, it was with the good intention, right, to even it out and say, look, we don't want disparity. And so let's make a common guideline that everybody has to apply. And so, yes, it started out, but in practice, like you said, it ended up being way too harsh. And courts couldn't vary from, because the problem is that everybody's case is different. And everybody's individual characteristics, personal history and characteristics are different. And so the problem became that you couldn't individualize the case. We went too far in trying to get rid of a disparity to the point where it didn't take into account mitigating factors. Now it's really important to work up the case, right? We have to work harder as defenders too, because now we have the tools to really tell the story of our client to the judges. So yeah, it's very interesting what happened there.
Yeah, which brings me actually naturally to what I wanted to ask about next, which is how you work up a case, right? What do you do when you get a case file or start writing a brief? How do you sort of go about that process, given especially that you've been doing it for a while and do it at volume with everybody else in your office?
So I'm not a trial attorney. I'm an appellate attorney. Maybe your next podcast could be with the trial who can take you from the beginning of the case, right?
Yeah, no, I'm curious about when you get involved and how that happens.
You know, sometimes I will get involved before the appeal. So I will, if there's an important legal issue, I really try to become a specialist in these criminal history issues on whether priors qualify as crimes of violence or controlled substance offense. So I get involved before the appeal, especially if I think it's going to go to appeal. And so I think the first thing I do is I start doing the research at the trial level and try to make the good arguments at the trial level. And then if it doesn't work, I've already got some background. I'm starting to mold the case, right? But then it becomes more intense at the appellate level. So yeah, I sit down and your first thing to always do is to read the transcript. Talk to the trial attorney, because you always want their perspective too about what they think, right? They don't read the entire transcript again, but they have some memory about what happened and what they thought worked and what they thought didn't work with the district court, because you've got to be able to respond to why the district court's reasoning was wrong when you're doing the appeal. So you have to get that down. And then, you know, I start with the Fourth Circuit to see what I can find in the Fourth Circuit that's helpful to my argument. But not only that, then I also email all the appellate people in the Fourth Circuit to see if dealt with this issue, what's going on in your districts. Sometimes you want to be able to give some statistics or some framework of what's going on practically in the other districts. So it's really important to contact the colleagues too to see what's going on there. And then sometimes if it's a national issue, right, it's a novel issue, I'll contact everybody. I'll send an email around federal defenders, the appellate defenders around the entire country to try to figure out what's going on. And I ask for briefs from everybody too, because that's also very helpful. We all build on each other to see what's out there. And then there's a lot of strategy involved too. Like sometimes you don't want your case to be the one to go first, because there may be some facts in your case that aren't the best for your goal, the rule you're trying to get the court to adopt. And so sometimes I will call a colleague and see if they have a better case to go forward first. So we try to figure things out with respect to timing that way too, to see what the better vehicle is.
What's so fascinating about that is when I think of appellate lawyer, especially appellate defender with the caseload that you have, I sort of think of the stoic alone in his office reading and writing. And what you described is a lot more strategic, a lot more communal, a lot more recursive in how you do research and then write and research and write. And that, I think that's important to understand also.
in the Fourth Circuit, we don't get that many oral arguments. It's probably a circuit that does the least amount of oral arguments, right? In some circuits, almost every case gets oral argument. In ours, not so much. So whenever I prepare for an oral argument, I always feel like I'm a baby again starting over because it's been months usually, right? Like 7-8 months usually before, you know. So I'm like, oh my God, I forgot how to do it. Because I always get very nervous at that part of it because you are performing, right? And so it's a very nerve-wracking process, the whole preparation. I would say that part is still, you know, usually lose a few pounds, lose sleep. It's on my mind 24 hours a day for probably 2 weeks before the argument. But I start preparing usually a month before. And what I mean by that is that I start really thinking, I start printing out my briefs and start printing out the cases, start organizing the way I want to think about things. And it takes a long time then to practice and get the words right. Like you can't memorize anything, but you can, I would say, memorize certain words or certain phrases, certain topics and how you want to convey them. It all takes practice. It's like an athlete, right? It takes a long time to become completely comfortable with the words and to become flexible with the, you have to know it well enough where the judge may ask you a question in a certain way that you didn't totally expect. It takes a while to get it all together and you know, you're comfortable with it enough to where you can be flexible. So the way we do get there is by doing moots with our colleagues and even sometimes people outside of our office. So we're not all thinking the same. Sometimes when you're in an office, you all start thinking the same, your friends. Group thinks, so sometimes you want people from the outside to come in to help you. And then those are very hard. The moots, they are harder than the actual argument because your colleagues are always going to be much harder and you want it that way. So you'll be prepared. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. Unfortunately, I would say I don't think oral arguments matter that much.
I was going to ask, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that you're always going to prepare, like you always have to prepare, like they do matter, and because they may matter in a few cases, right? But I think the majority of the cases, this is my opinion, but I feel like it's a lot of drama. You're going up there and the judges are kind of talking to themselves. That's the first time they're talking about the case with each other, I think. So they're trying to figure out what judge is thinking, right? And trying to convince the judges. So sometimes there's some of that going on, but most of the time they come in and you can tell that they have a plan. But sometimes I think if they're on your side, you could screw it up if you do something or concede something or not willing to concede. So I don't know. It's different for every case. You always have to go in there being sharp. And sometimes you do make a difference. I can think of a case where it did make a difference. Like there was something not in my brief, right? There were these documents with respect to a prior case, a prior precedent. And those documents were really important. And I remember bringing them up at oral argument because sometimes the light bulb goes off while you're preparing for oral argument thinking, oh my God, I wish I put this in the brief. That always happens, right? And so this is one of those cases where the light bulb went off and I'm like, I have to try to get them to focus on these documents that I didn't really talk about in my brief, because then they'll see that case that I'm relying on is exactly like our case. And so they have to win that way. And so I remember that that was an argument where it made a difference. Those documents were really important and their eyes just lit up. They're like, oh, wow. Like I could see it on the bench. And then the government, it was really difficult for them to respond to those documents. So
that's interesting. I've interviewed a couple of appellate attorneys for the podcast, and more than one has suggested that maybe if folks mooted their briefs instead of waiting to moot to oral argument, they might actually find things. The challenge, of course, is time and energy and everything else, but it's an interesting exercise. I do want to take a chance to turn to sort of thinking about what kinds of people would make good public defenders and sort of how to make that process happen. But before we do, I guess my only other question about your practice is, you've mentioned the human element of what you're doing. And so I imagine a lot of your briefs, your written argument, is about the story of the person and what happened. And a lot of it is sort of what the legal standards are. How do you balance sort of story and law in the briefs that you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, and that's hard, right? Because sometimes you want them to see your client as a human, even though there's a very like distinct legal issue. So there is a balancing there because you don't want to put in all this irrelevant stuff. But you always have to give them a reason for why they want to rule for your client. And so there has to be some human element, no matter how you get it in there. I think it is important to do that. And the way to do that sometimes is, you know, in the statement of the case, when you're just presenting before you get to argument. I mean, you should think of everything as argument, really, even though it's not technically argument. So you just paint this picture of how we got to the legal error. And in the course of that, you know, there's a gentle way of telling the court what your client is like. And so I think there's always a way to do it. And then they're also always thinking about the policy implications. And you never want to advocate for, sometimes you have to, but most of the time, you don't want to advocate for a really broad rule that goes, you know, so you want to be able to do it. It's like, this case is unique to my client, and there's something very unique about what happened here. So that's something I try to do when I can, even though it's going to impact a lot of people. You have to, they're always afraid of opening up the floodgates of litigation. I think judges are. Anyways, that's all to say, like, that helps, you know, helps to individualize it to your client and what happened here and your client's vulnerabilities, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And as someone who teaches legal writing for a living, it's something that we try to teach, but it's a challenge, right? To sort of teach, when you're covering a statement of the case, statement of facts, using that as an opportunity to persuade. But I loved how you used the word gently. I try to tell my students that it doesn't actually help your case to sort of do the writing equivalent of banging on the table.
That's very important, Jim, because I mean, you don't have to scream at them. That's not the way to do oral argument.
Right. It's not the way to do oral argument. And you don't want them to feel like they're being screamed at when they're reading your brief either, right?
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard because I'm like, I want to italicize that word. But, you know, you got to be careful about all of that. You got to be very professional. And you should never write with a tone where you're angry at the other side. I don't think that, even if I am often very angry at the government, but you cannot convey that.
And I guess the last question I had as you were giving your last answer is, you started talking about the humanity or the circumstance of your client. Do you spend a lot of time with your clients as an appellate advocate, or no?
We don't. Sometimes we've started at the trial level. We get a lot more contact with the client. And you know what? I always like that because we don't get to see our clients as much. There are conversations on the phone. But when you're doing appeal and our clients are incarcerated at the BOP, there's not that much talk on the call because it's all based on the record. But we can never forget about the client. And it's so nice when we do get to see a client. Like, it brings back, like, why am I doing this? It just, there's a lot of heart there. Usually, I don't care what you've done as a human being. When you sit down with that human being, I mean, I've represented, you know, some people who've committed murders or were convicted of murder. And it doesn't matter. You see the human side. I don't care what you've done. And that's what the very nice thing about a public defender is. Like, on paper, people may seem horrendous and their acts may be horrendous, what they've done. But when you sit down with that person face to face and you're the only person advocating for that person, you know, the defendant, there's just a connection that happens often, more often than not, where you see this person who was just like you when you were born, and you were equal, and their circumstances, whatever they were not the same as yours, and something went wrong. But it's really nice to remember that. And so I always feel like if there's one thing I could change in the criminal justice system, is that the prosecutors have to spend a day with our clients. I feel like that would change everything. If that was a requirement, or even sitting down with their family members, you would see a big difference in what they prosecuted and the types of sentences that they advocated for.
It's an interesting way you put it, that it's about the things that they've done as opposed to them as human beings, your clients. And I think that's very powerful as well. You know, I do want to talk a little bit about how to become a public defender or how to do what you do. I know that it can be quite challenging. It's not an easy job to get. It's not always the highest paying job out there. The process can be a little messy. And I guess I'm just curious what your recommendation to someone who, say, is in law school and says, you know, I think I might be interested in this. What are some of the paths to entering sort of a career in public defense?
So that's a great question. And people in my office at the Federal Defender have come here from very different paths. So there's not a one right way of doing it. For me, I knew I wanted to do it. It was still hard because I didn't know. I liked the writing part of it, and I wanted to be an appellate defender. So, you know, in New York City, I was very lucky to get a job there where there was an entry level appellate defender office where we only took a few cases, and the supervisors were with us the entire way. So it didn't seem so overwhelming. So they would read the entire transcript with us. They would think about the issues with us. The drafts would go back and forth a million times. And then we were mooted three times. Sometimes we had to do four if they didn't think we were prepared enough. And no, the pay was not great at all. But you can find a way to make a living, I think, if it's really what you want to do. But if you're interested in appellate defense, like the Office of the Appellate Defender in New York, it's hard to get a job there because it's a small office. But there are other offices like that. If you want to be a trial attorney, I think that, you know, it's always good to try to start at the trial level or at the state level, because the federal defenders don't usually hire people right out of law school. And at the state level, it is overwhelming because you'll have hundreds of cases. Our caseload is nothing compared to the state defenders, but you'll also learn how to quickly think on your feet, you know, how to handle people, clients, judges, lawyers. You're in the courtroom quite a bit more than the federal defenders are. You know, if you want to be a public defender, I think there's a lot of value in starting at the state defender offices. But one thing I would recommend too is that clerkships are really important, I think, because the world we live in, I don't think they should be as important, but they just are because people think of them as prestigious. And so I think if you can do a clerkship, do it for a year, and you will learn a lot, and you'll learn how to, and for your writing skills, it's really important whether you're going to write a law or not in a state defender office. If you want to move on to a federal defender office, your writing skills have to be very good. And I think that will be helpful for that reason too. So I think I would recommend doing a clerkship, and preferably a federal clerkship, or even a state Supreme Court or appellate clerkship is good because you'll get a lot of writing experience that way. And it's okay if you don't do a clerkship. I think go to a state defender and try there. And sometimes try at the federal defender too. You can start as a research and writing attorney, which is sometimes an entry-level trial attorney, and some offices treat it as an entry-level appellate position. So you can also do that and be flexible if you really want to be a public defender. It's really competitive in this area, in the DC area and in the Northeast. Go somewhere else. Go where you're really needed. Go to the South for a few years. Go wherever, Midwest. It doesn't matter, right? So I think if you're willing to be flexible, that's a good thing too on that level. And then even if you go to a law firm, I think it's fine if you want to switch to federal, because you do learn very good skills about detail there and hard work and being meticulous. And I think that does translate over to the work of a defender.
Fantastic. I mean, I think so many of the things you said apply to so many areas of the law, but especially the area that you work in, that getting a set of skills, becoming a strong writer, getting experience on detail, geographic flexibility helps. Not everybody has it. Not everybody can have it. But if you can, it certainly doesn't hurt. So yeah, I think that's very helpful.
The last thing I would just wanted to say is also try to do internship. If you know you're interested in public, just do. Yeah, because that matters too. When you go to public defender interviews, they're going to be like, well, where's the commitment if you haven't, or if you've just worked at a law firm all 3 years in the summer, then that doesn't look great when you're saying, I really want to be a public defender. People won't believe you. So, and again, you may come to that decision later and after your lawyer maybe, and that's fine. And if that decision comes later, even if you're at a law firm, a lot of the people in our office that have come from law firms, and there's a lot of them from big law firms, they were doing very good pro bono work. And that's what inspired them to, working on capital cases, death penalty cases, which can be very complex, very legally complex, but really great work. And law firms sometimes help in that area and other. Yeah, so there's opportunities there. So you take them when you're at a law firm, so that you can then go to the public defender office and be convincing that you really want to do this work. It's not for everyone either.
Right. That's what I was going to ask, actually, is like, are there personalities or, you know, we talked a lot about skills, but I'm more interested in like, are there personalities that fit really well, or are there sort of fundamental beliefs or approaches to the world that make doing your job more fulfilling, as opposed to things that if you see it in the mirror and you see it in the mirror every day, it's maybe not a good fit for you?
Yeah. Like, so first of all, you have to be the type of person that is okay with losing, because we are the underdog. We always will be. And so there's great highs that you're going to have where you win a trial, you know, or you win an appeal, or you get a really good result for your client. But there's a lot of lows too, right? You have to be one of these people that's very optimistic. And I think if you're not, then you're going to get beaten down emotionally. Some people, their heart's very good and they really want to do this work, but they can't take all the pain that comes with it. There's a lot of pain and a lot of loss. And some of my colleagues that do capital work, I mean, the end result is your client dies and is killed. And so, you know, a lot of people do non-capital work and there's devastating losses there too, mandatory life sentences. And sometimes, you know, now there's all sorts of ways out that weren't around 18 years ago when I started, even if your client gets life, but that's devastating. I think you have to be a certain personality where you can't be, you can be an overachiever. I think everybody's an overachiever in our office. I think most lawyers are, but you can't let it get in the way of your mission. Because if you get beaten down to a point where you get burned out, that's not good either. And then you stop really fighting the government. But yeah, I mean, I lost a case. It's an issue I've been working on for many, many years recently. Sometimes I forgot to talk about this. I go back to the state court of appeals and the state, if there's a prior conviction that enhanced our client's sentence, sometimes we go to state court to try to get it vacated. But there was this question, I got certified to the court of appeals and I lost. And now that means that there's a certain category of clients that are going to get these mandatory 15. So it was hard because I was working on it for a really long time and I really believed in it. But sometimes no matter what you do, there's going to be that loss. But then you start thinking about other ways in which now I can help these clients. So there's always, you always have to get yourself together and start thinking about what can I do next to, and there's a lot of creativity and there's a lot of ways of thinking about how do I start thinking about the next issue? And it may develop into something that's really good for a broad group of people. So,
wow, I think that's really powerful. Yeah, that's got to be an element of hope and be of playing the very long incremental gain. Very long and incremental game where sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, but that doesn't mean you can stop fighting.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen real systemic change in the last 18 years, like solid constructive change in our clients' sentences. For example, this Armed Career Criminal Act that I was telling you about, the mandatory 15 years, it used to be so many people got that. But now, even when somebody is absolutely eligible for the Armed Criminal Act, even the prosecutors, they know that it's too harsh and they offer you a deal where your client can plead to something that will not trigger that 15 years. That would have been inconceivable like 10 years ago or 20, but it's because we really fought and won all these cases. So I think that sometimes they think it's not worth litigating, you know, on something like this when we don't even really believe that the client should be in jail that long. And so, you know, I've seen changes like that in the last 18 years, 18 and a half years. So, and we have people here, a couple who've been here, three that have been here longer than I have. So, and then a bunch of people who've been here like 9 or 10 years. So it's not just a fleeting job where people just stay for 2 years and run. And that's one thing I wanted to say about just the final push on federal defense work. It's a lot more manageable with like lifestyle. Like there's a lot of people have fun, they travel, you can do things like that. Your caseload is far lower than it is at the state level. It's manageable. You have a lot of time to think about your cases and really develop strategy. It's a lot more slow moving at the federal level. The pay is, I think, unbelievable. I mean, you know, as far as it's federal government, so it's at the highest levels of the federal government. So, you know, you can have a very nice lifestyle. You don't have to live like a pauper. I mean, you can live well too, relatively speaking.
I'm so grateful that you've taken the time for this interview. You know, the question I always end with is for a piece of advice about something you wish you knew, sort of either when you started law school or certainly when you were graduating and just starting out that you know now. Does anything come to mind that you wish you had known maybe 18 and a half years ago when you started this journey that you now know?
You know, when I finished law school, I guess, I thought, okay, or maybe when I started, I thought after these 3 years, I will know how to do everything. They're going to teach me how to do everything, but you won't know anything. I'm not a dig on the professors. I think the way I think of it now looking back is law school is really important because it teaches you how to think and it teaches you how to do analysis. And that's the most important thing. And that's the only thing I think you really take from law school, but then it's a whole new world. It's like you're starting over again. You're starting another law school about practice. It's not just, it's going to take a very long time. And the analytical skills that you've gained from law school, that's very important. But now it's a whole different ballgame of putting it into practice. And there's one other thing I will say. I think when I started in law school, I thought everything that was written by a judge was gold, that it had to be the Bible, that there were no flaws in the reasoning. But now, after practicing, judges make mistakes, and they make huge mistakes, and their reasoning is often wrong. That doesn't mean that you weren't a good advocate. I think that one of the lessons from that is that when you are advocating, be critical of the court's decisions, right? Because sometimes you're going to have to argue, you know, why this bad case in the 10th Circuit shouldn't apply to your case. And I think after all this time, I've learned that it's okay. Like judges make me, their reasoning isn't always good. It's flawed. And I think as a law student, when I first started, I just thought, oh my God, if it's on paper, if a judge wrote it, that means that.
No, absolutely. I think it's an important lesson and one that candidly we all need to think about sometimes. And we have a whole system predicated on finding times when judges are wrong or not exactly right. And there's a reason for that. And I appreciate that. But look.
Yeah, you have to remember they're human, just like you and me, you know. They were lawyers. They went to law school just like you and me. So don't put them on a pedestal. That's what I would say, right?
I like that. Well, I won't share that necessarily with my guests who are judges, but no, I really do enjoy that. And it's been great getting to talk to you, Paresh, and I'm so grateful that you took the time to meet for the podcast. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jen. It was really fun. Thank you very much. I'm honored. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.